In 1991, 13-year-old Heather Dawn Church was abducted from her home in Colorado Springs. It took investigators many months to locate her body and 4 years to find her murderer, Robert Charles Brown, who was convicted and sentenced to life in the Colorado State Penitentiary. Then, several years after that, a team of volunteers who lived in the Colorado Springs area, a retired homicide detective, a retired newspaper publisher, and a retired federal agent, started to go through the files of unsolved crimes, so-called cold cases. One of the items they came across was a cryptic note from Robert Brown that led them to believe he might be one of the worst serial killers in American history. One of those volunteer investigators, Charlie Hess, started to exchange letters with Brown. Later they met, and Charlie continually probed to uncover the truth of Brown's claim that he'd left the bodies of dozens of victims buried in 17 different states. If you have questions for Charlie Hess about the investigation, about his relationship with Robert Charles Brown, we'd like to hear from you. Our phone number is 800-989-8255. The email address is talk@npr.org, and you can join the conversation on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. Charlie Hess, who was an agent for the CIA and for the FBI, joins us now from Pan Studios in Colorado Springs, Colorado. He's the author of a new book, Hello, Charlie, Letters from a Serial Killer. And Charlie Hess, good of you to join us today.
Good morning, or good afternoon. Thank you very much for having me.
And interestingly, one of the things you write about in this correspondence with this serial killer is that your experience talking with, pimps and hookers and criminals, all of that came in tremendous value to you, a tremendous experience to you as you try to establish a relationship with a convicted child killer.
Well, that's correct. I learned a long time ago when I was a young agent in the FBI. I learned an awfully lot from old-time Texas sheriffs and people who had been in the law enforcement business. And, you know, you see on television the interrogation techniques of hitting people in the head with a telephone book and so forth and so on. And these old-timers, they were so smooth. They never interrogated. They didn't even interview. They just talked. And the big thing that I learned from these guys was, you know, you just have to find one single reason why this individual is willing to talk to you, whether it be a witness or a defendant or a suspect or whatever. And using that over the years, I found that that worked very well for me. Obviously, there are differences of opinion as to techniques in interrogation, interviewing, and so forth, but it depends on the individual and how he can make contact. The big thing is you have to be able to establish some sort of rapport.
And that I can understand that, but first of all, when you started exchanging letters with Robert Brown, you first of all didn't. He was already in prison for life, and you didn't have an awful lot of leverage. And also, a lot of people would say it's hard not to be judgmental about a man who's already been convicted of killing a 13-year-old girl.
Well, you're absolutely correct. And in my case, my procedure was before I would go in to see Robert. The night before, I would normally condition myself. There are two things that people like Robert require. One is respect. Two is that you be non-judgmental. Well, you just cited, you know, how do you deal with that sort of situation? And I would be telling myself the night before, okay, now tomorrow when I go in to see Robert, what I'm going to do is we're going to talk as we have before, respectfully to each other. We never had a contentious moment. We talked about a lot of things besides the murders that he committed, and we finally established sort of a format where we could exchange information, and instead of having to, quote, drag it out of him, he would volunteer it because we had arrived at that state.
Mm-hmm. That personal relationship, you write under other circumstances, you could consider him a friend, even though you acknowledge that if he weren't in maximum security prison, he would just as cheerfully murder you.
Well, it's probably true. I'm not sure that friend is exactly the word that I searched for when we were doing the book. But when I brought that up with Robert one time, I said, you know, we've developed a pretty decent relationship here over the years, because this was a 4-year project. And Robert said, well, you know, I'm not friends. I don't know if we're friends or not. But he said, we certainly have established a relationship. And he said, I can talk to you, and I don't feel embarrassed, and I'm willing to cooperate and so forth. So it in a way, I guess you're correct. It was a friendship, but could I ever take him out to dinner? No. Would I discuss with him things of a personal nature? Yes. I remember before my wife was having open-heart surgery, I had to go in to have a hip replaced. And I wrote to Robert and I said, you know, I may be out of touch for a while. I have to get a hip replaced so that when she has her surgery, that I'll be able to accommodate whatever her needs are. And Robert wrote back and he said, he knew my wife's name because we had mentioned that before. And he said, well, I hope everything goes well with Joe in her operation, and I hope everything goes well in yours. And the next time we get together, he says, you can tell me how things are turning out.
We'll take calls with Charlie Hess about his relationship with a serial killer at 800-989-8255. Email talk@npr.org. But I want to ask you a couple of questions first, one of which was, what was in it for you? And of course, it was not just you. You had two partners in what became known, I guess, as the Apple Dumpling Gang. And they were Lou Smith, another retired investigator, and Scott Fisher, a retired newspaper publisher. And it was interesting to me that one of the quotes you attribute to this process of working on cold cases is the thing that we were most concerned with was that we didn't want our brains to dry up.
Well, you know, I'm 81. Lou's in his 60s, 65, 67, something like that. Scott's a lot younger. He's probably 10 years younger than Lou. And we were all retired, and the sheriff here at that time, John Anderson, we all knew him through various vehicles. And we went to him and said, you know, we'd like to volunteer our services. We just don't want to sit on the couch and watch television and just shrivel up and waste whatever talents we may have gained over the years. And Sheriff Anderson was delighted, and therefore we began almost immediately going through these cold cases. And as you indicated in the introduction, we came across a note, a tease note that Robert had written to the district attorney.
And that raises the second question. So we just found out what was in it for you. What was in it for him?
Well, you know, to this day, I can't tell you explicitly except that when we first started out and we knew that we were going to exchange information or that he was going to provide information, I said, well, you know, Robert, there's got to be a quid pro quo from your end. And at first he said, no, there's nothing I want. I said, well, you don't. You told me once you don't have a conscience. And he said, no, I don't. And I said, well, it's not that. I said, you've indicated you don't really care whether or not these various families have closure. And he said, no. And I said, so, you know, it puzzles me that we've developed this relationship and you don't seem to be wanting anything. Well, it didn't take very long, perhaps another visit or two, before Robert said to me, you know, I'd really like to get a single cell. Well, you know, the prisons are overcrowded, and he had a cellmate, and Robert is a loner. He doesn't want, he's very antisocial. He's very smart guy. He's got an IQ of 145, but he wants to be alone. And our Department of Corrections here in Colorado is outstanding. They're absolutely incredibly cooperative people. And we went to them and laid out the scenario and said, this is what we think this guy can give us. And right now what he'd like to do is he'd have a single cell. And, of course, it was not an easy thing for them to put together, but they did and provided a single cell. And those were the kind of things that that we were able to do for him while he was in prison. There are opportunities in there for different types of work, and he wanted a job. And the average prisoner receives about 30 cents a day, and that goes into his commissary fund. And from that 30 cents a day, whatever his commissary fund will bear, he's able to buy his own shaving equipment, soap, Fritos, a can of Coca-Cola or whatever. And if you don't have money, well, you just can't, you do without. And in Robert's case, he wanted a job. And if you do certain types of jobs, you get about 60 cents a day. And the ultimate job is the license plate factory, where you get about a dollar a day. And these were the kind of things that we were able to provide through the good graces of the Department of Corrections.
Our guest is Charlie Hess. He's the author, along with Davin Say, of Hello, Charlie, Letters from a Serial Killer, How Three Cold Case Cops Took on One of America's Most Notorious Mass Murderers. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's get a caller on the line. This is Derek. Derek with us from Madison in Wisconsin.
Yes, hi. Charlie, it's great to hear you talk. It's almost like having a conversation with my own father. He's a retired police detective, and even though I wasn't involved with that kind of work myself, I've learned a lot, and a lot's rubbed off on me. A couple interesting things about my dad. He had a special knack for interrogations and getting confessions, and he says kind of what he would say about reflects what you said, that, you know, it doesn't take a lot of a drama and anything drastic. It's mostly conversational. But one thing that my father has a passion for in life, that he has a passion for it individually, to develop it, and also to inspire other people to develop this passion. And that is that, regardless of anybody's situation, to see dignity and have respect in them, like humane dignity, regardless of what they've done, because no one is beyond forgiveness, no one is beyond mercy, nobody is beyond that people may actually be beyond ability to be rehabilitated in behaviors, but they're still, and the way he would put it, is from my own father's point of view, is that we all carry the spark of the divine, and you have to, not only does he try to develop his own ability to see that divine in others, he's very inspirational in helping to teach other people to do the same thing. And he approached criminals in the same way as he would approach a pastor or a church volunteer. They all have that same dignity, absolutely and completely. And if you engage them on that level, you're gonna be able to have their best interest in mind. And you know, my dad still gets letters from guys who are sitting in prison, and they're a friendly tone. They're like, they're almost trying to impress him, like, hey, you know, I still got 8 more years or whatever, but, you know, I'm on good behavior, or I've been promoted to a different level of, you know, different jobs I can do, et cetera. So I really think that that's been key to his success.
Derek, thanks very much for that. Appreciate it.
Well, make a comment in that regard. He was certainly in the same sort of mode that I was. As a matter of fact, some prisoners that I've spoken to during their time during incarceration have been paroled now, and there are a couple of them that I go out and have coffee and donuts with once in a while.
Hmm. In the end of the day, you started this project when Robert Brown was already in prison for the rest of his life. He's still there. What do you think you accomplished?
I think our biggest accomplishment was the fact that he did provide details of unsolved murders. He would never use that word. He used the word cases. Unsolved murders in various states. And we were able to bring a degree of closure to these families. There's no such thing as complete closure. From personal experience, my son-in-law was murdered when he interrupted a burglary in progress by three young gangbangers. And that was back in 1991 also. And although there's been a lot of healing, especially on my daughter's part, his wife, to this day, we have not been able to resurrect Stephen. I mean, sure. he was killed, and yes, we know who did it, and yes, they're incarcerated, and there is a certain amount of relief there, but it's never erased from your mind.
Charlie Hess, thanks very much. By the way, you working on any new cases?
I am. I've got a couple that are going and talking with the individuals. The Apple Dumpling Gang doesn't exist anymore with the sheriff's office. Scott Fisher moved out of town, and Lou Smith's going to be doing extensive traveling. And my wife passed away in October, and I don't know what my plans are, but I am working on a couple of things with another ex-cop.
And Charlie, we wish you the best of luck, and so sorry to hear about Joe. Thanks very much for being with us today, Charlie Hess. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News.